Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov.
Hello, everyone. My name is Paige Schilling, and I'm an intelligence analyst at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and my portfolio includes Hezbollah. So today, in the first half of the podcast, I'm going to provide you with an overview of the group's background, including their history, leadership, terror attacks, recruitment, and financing. The second half of the presentation will highlight the nexus between criminal activity and terrorism. Since 2006, nearly 20 Hezbollah-related cases have been prosecuted in 10 states, including cases involving the sale of stolen or counterfeit goods, narcotics and cigarette trafficking, and money laundering. And when I talk about Hezbollah, I want you to think about them not only as a terrorist group, but also as a transnational organized crime network, where generating money is a top priority to fund their initiatives in the Middle East. So first and foremost, I want to clarify that the threat of Hezbollah conducting a terror attack in the United States or in New Jersey is low, and this is due to a variety of reasons, but primarily because the group is regionally focused and they are committed to upholding Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria. Secondly, Hezbollah has never conducted a terrorist attack on U.S. soil. However, supporters and sympathizers of the group remain in the region, engaging primarily in fundraising activities. And this is demonstrated by a number of Hezbollah-related cases that have been federally prosecuted in the United States. And although none of these have been prosecuted in New Jersey, a number have been tried in New York and Pennsylvania, and some defendants that have been tried were New Jersey residents. So a quick overview of the group. Hezbollah is an Islamic militant group based in Lebanon and allied with Iran. The name of the group literally means Party of Allah or Party of God. In 1997, Hezbollah was designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the United States. Since its inception, the primary goal of the group has been the destruction of Israel. And although this continues to be a rallying point for the group, its involvement in Syria has really shifted its focus, and I'll go over that a bit more later. So a brief history. Hezbollah was founded in 1982 in response to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Israel's invasion was intended to expel Palestinian militants in southern Lebanon, and Hezbollah was formed as a result of this invasion, and their main goal was to expel Israel from Lebanese territory. Initially, Iran's Revolutionary Guards and Syria sponsored the group and provided direct support, including financial and training assistance to Hezbollah. This assistance allowed Hezbollah to expand from the Bekaa Valley of eastern Lebanon, its base of operations, to the southern suburbs of Beirut and the Shiite hill towns of the south. In 1985, Hezbollah published its founding manifesto, addressed to the downtrodden in Lebanon and in the world. It outlined characteristics of membership and its goals. Hezbollah pledged its loyalty to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, and urged the establishment of an Islamic regime. Above all, the manifesto called for the destruction of the Israeli state and also for the ejection of the United States, France, and Israel from Lebanese territory. According to Israeli officials, the 15-year occupation of Lebanon was strictly to secure its borders. Throughout the 1990s, Hezbollah continued to clash with Israel because of this occupation. In 1993, Israel launched Operation Accountability after Hezbollah killed 7 Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon. Again, in 1996, Israel launched Operation Grapes of Wrath in retaliation for Hezbollah rocket attacks on northern Israel. So growing Israeli casualties increased domestic pressure for Israel to end its occupation of Lebanon. The Israeli prime minister in 1999 promised to pull Israeli troops from Lebanon within a year. And in 2000, a full troop withdrawal was voted on unanimously by the Israeli cabinet, and Israel withdrew from southern Lebanon, and it was largely in part to this pressure that was applied by Hezbollah. On July 12, 2006, Hezbollah attacked Israeli soldiers in northern Lebanon on the Lebanese border, capturing 2 soldiers and killing 8. On July 13th, the following day, Israel began retaliatory offenses, and this included blockading Lebanon from the sea and bombing offices that belonged to the leader of Hezbollah. Hezbollah launched an Iranian missile that destroyed an Israeli naval vessel and killed four sailors. So initially, this outbreak attracted widespread international condemnation of Hezbollah. So many countries, including Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, all voiced the opinion that Hezbollah had violated Israel's territory. Israel continued to strike roads, bridges, seaports, and airports throughout southern Lebanon in its pursuit of destroying Hezbollah. The civilian population in the area was forced to flee after hundreds of targets had been struck. After the bombing of the Lebanese city of Qana on July 30th, which killed 28 civilians, public support of Israel began to diminish. Meanwhile, many in the Shia community praised Hezbollah's actions. In mid-August 2006, the United Nations and Lebanon brokered a ceasefire after the war had raged for 34 days. During this time, half the population of northern Israel, around 500,000 people, were displaced. Additionally, 900,000 people in southern Lebanon were evacuated. 43 Israelis and 1,100 Lebanese civilians perished in the war. Israel incurred $500 million worth of damage, while Lebanon suffered $4 billion. So the memory of this war and the destruction it caused helped keep both sides at bay currently. So although Hezbollah and Israel continue to have small confrontations, they haven't escalated into full-out warfare. So Hezbollah has a variety of identities. So the U.S. considers Hezbollah a terrorist organization. But throughout Lebanon and much of the Middle East, the group is respected as basically a government. They provide social services, including schools, hospitals, mosques, clinics, community centers, and public assistance facilities. So this aspect differentiates Hezbollah from other terrorist groups. And it also feeds into the recruitment. So because Hezbollah offers these social services, they fill a hole where the Lebanese government is lacking, and they always have a willing pool of membership. In 1992, Hezbollah entered the political realm, and today Hezbollah holds 12 out of 128 seats in parliament. And that may not seem like a lot, but the political bloc that Hezbollah is aligned with is called the March 8 Alliance, and it holds 57 out of those 128 seats. And this provides Hezbollah with a greater amount of influence. The last parliamentary elections took place in 2009, and since then the parliament has continued to expand and extend its mandate to continue operating. Lebanon has been without a president since May of 2014, when the prior president's term expired. So the March 8 bloc has been boycotting the election sessions, and all of this has really contributed to an unstable Lebanese government. So the leader of Hezbollah is the general secretary, who is chosen by a 7-member Shura Council. Hezbollah's current leader has been in power since 1992 and is the third secretary general that Hezbollah has had. So when you look at other terror groups, you may notice leadership turnover frequently, but that can't be said for Hezbollah. The group has maintained consistent leadership for many years. And right now, currently, the leader of Hezbollah is Hassan Nasrallah. So the council elects the secretary general for 3-year term, and the council oversees 5 sub-councils: the political assembly, the jihad assembly, the parliamentary assembly, the executive assembly, and the judicial assembly. So each head of the sub-assembly has a seat on the Shura Council, and this allows Hezbollah to be controlled by a unified leadership. I'm not going to go into each assembly, but the one that I want to point out is the Jihad or Military Assembly, and it coordinates terrorist activities, including the oversight, recruitment, training, equipment, security, and any other resistance-related endeavor. And this sub-assembly is divided into several smaller units, which are in charge of protecting the leadership, carrying out internal and external surveillances, and overseeing security in general. So Hezbollah has killed around 260 U.S. citizens, all of which occurred in 1983. In October 1983, Hezbollah sent 2 suicide truck bombers to attack separate buildings housing U.S. and French military forces. In total, 299 people were killed, including 241 U.S. service personnel. In April 1983, a Hezbollah suicide bomber crashed another VB-IED into the U.S. embassy in Lebanon. The vehicle was carrying 2,000 pounds of explosives. It killed 63 people total, including 17 Americans. And before 9/11, Hezbollah had killed the most Americans of any terrorist organization. So Hezbollah's message in 1983 was clear, that they would attack countries and continue to attack countries that they felt had violated Lebanon's territory. The U.S. had entered Lebanon in 1982 with the help of European military to help the Lebanese government maintain stability during the Lebanese Civil War. Hezbollah's strategy of using suicide bombers to drive out U.S. and French forces worked, and following these attacks, the United States left Lebanon. So I've heard before that some people don't think Hezbollah is a terrorist organization, and they base these thoughts on the premise that they don't think the group has been associated with any highly publicized attacks since 1983. In 2014, Matthew Olson, the then director of the NCTC, stated, "Hezbollah remains committed to conducting terrorist activities worldwide, and we remain concerned the group's activities could either endanger or target U.S. and other Western interests. The group has engaged in an aggressive terrorist campaign in recent years and continues attack planning abroad." So the recent plots conducted by Hezbollah have targeted Israeli citizens and interests globally, but we have yet to see that activity morph into the United States. So very quickly, a few recent plots: January 2016 in the West Bank, May of 2015 in Cyprus, April of 2014 in Thailand, October of 2014 in Peru, May of 2013 in Nigeria, and March of 2013 in Cyprus. In January 2016 in the West Bank, Israeli security forces foiled a terror suicide bombing and shooting cell that was under the control of Jawad Nasrallah, and he is the son of Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah. A total of 5 Palestinians were arrested on suspicion of joining the Hezbollah terrorist cell. According to the Israeli intelligence service, the cell was close to launching attacks. The 5 suspects had been indicted and charged with membership in a illegal organization, contact with the enemy, and an array of other different terrorist charges. Jawad Nasrallah allegedly used social media networks to recruit a man in the West Bank, who then in turn recruited other Palestinians. The individual received instructions from Hezbollah through a handler on how to recruit others, gather field intelligence, and select targets. The cell was instructed to use secret communications equipment to receive instructions on how to carry out suicide bombings, assemble bomb vests, gather intelligence, and set up training camps. And Hezbollah provided $5,000 from abroad to advance the plot. Allegedly, a gun was also acquired to aid in a shooting attack on the Israeli military. So the interesting part about this plot is the fact that no Hezbollah operatives were actually physically in the area, and they used social media and the internet to communicate and instruct the would-be attackers. In May of 2015, authorities in Cyprus arrested Hezbollah member Hossein Bassam Abdallah after they discovered 9 tons of ammonium nitrate in his basement. The suspect admitted that Hezbollah was going to use the explosives to target Israelis in Cyprus. His role was to guard the chemical and move it to different locations as necessary. He was paid around $10,500 by the group. He confessed to visiting Cyprus around 10 times since 2012 to check on the ammonium nitrate as it was stockpiled. He pled guilty to 8 terrorism charges that were filed against him, and in June he was sentenced to 6 years in prison. So a few things I want to point out about this incident. The group is continuing to target Israelis abroad through the use of operatives, so not only plotting attacks, but also conducting surveillance to watch the movement of Israelis. Secondly, Hezbollah is patient. This individual was charged with his actions from 2012 to 2015. So for 3 years, he was tasked with overseeing the chemical as it was stockpiled. And third, that's a lot of explosives, so 9 tons of ammonium nitrate. And to put that in context for you, that's similar to the size of 1.5 adult elephants. And mixed with fuel, it would equate to almost 15,000 pounds of TNT. A final note about Hezbollah and their attack planning is that they're unlikely to ever claim responsibility for these plots or attacks. The group will attempt to distance itself from these incidents, and this is in stark contrast to other groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda that always seem to be claiming responsibility in an effort to gain publicity for their groups. There's 2 main reasons why Hezbollah is different. The first is that Hezbollah's involvement in the political system is valuable, and it wants to be viewed as a legitimate actor. So claiming responsibilities for these attacks or plots would work against them. Secondly, linked closely to the first point is the understanding that some states have yet to label Hezbollah as a foreign terrorist organization, and they want to avoid other countries from labeling and designating them as that. And that's because with this designation come sanctions that really impede their ability to conduct financial business globally. In sum, almost all of these activities are conducted covertly to avoid negative attention. Hezbollah uses an array of recruitment tactics in the social realm, including schools and scouts, their version of the Boy Scouts. Recruitment is a process of mobilization along family lines, especially in southern Lebanon, where Hezbollah holds much of its influence. The scouts were established by Hezbollah in 1985 and have branches in Shiite communities of Beirut, the Bekaa Valley, and southern Lebanon. The scouts number around 50,000 members, and they range in age from 4 to 17. This organization is really used to groom future Hezbollah members and teaches youth the principles of the Iranian Revolution and radical Shiism. Hezbollah encourages young children to become involved in the movement through lectures, plays, and sporting events. And some scouts do become full-fledged members, while others become lifelong supporters of the group. In early 2013, Hezbollah announced that it had established a scout group in Syria, which is going in the future to feed into a new population of support for the group beyond Lebanon. In 2014, an individual was arrested in Michigan and charged with attempting to provide material support after he tried to travel to Syria to help Hezbollah in the civil war. This individual had previously been active within the Hezbollah ranks during the war with Israel in 2006, and as a child was involved in their public assistance program. So this case really exemplifies the loyalty the group is able to instill in members, especially considering that this person was involved in Hezbollah as a child. So Hezbollah also uses social media and television to spread its message. Hezbollah owns Al-Manar, which is a television network affiliated with the group and broadcasted from Beirut. Al-Manar was established in 1991, and Hezbollah was the first terrorist organization to establish its own television station. Al-Manar was banned from the United States in 2004, and it's also banned in a number of other countries, including France, Spain, and Germany. In Lebanon, Al-Manar is the third most popular television station and features news, talk shows, documentary series, music videos, and other elements all dedicated to Hezbollah. In 2006, a man in New York City was arrested for operating a broadcasting company where he provided access to Al-Manar. He was sentenced to 5.5 years in prison. Hezbollah also uses accounts on social media, on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, and we hear a lot in the news about groups like the Islamic State using social media to entice recruits and radicalize Westerners. And I want to clarify that although Hezbollah uses social media, it's not in the same way. Sites on Facebook and Twitter are used to gather support for those who are already sympathizers or grew up attached to the group. So when it comes to financial support, Hezbollah receives training, weaponry, and up to $200 million a year in financial support from Iran. The group may receive more funding, dependent on the Iranian nuclear deal that Iran negotiated with the P5 plus one, which was the United States, France, Germany, the United Kingdom, Russia, China, plus the European Union. According to the U.S. Treasury Department, lifting sanctions will provide Iran with an estimated $100 billion, although it's unknown at this time what additional funding Iran will deliver to Hezbollah. The group is currently involved in the Syrian civil war, supporting the Bashar al-Assad regime. So they're fighting against rebel forces, the Al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front, and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Initially, Hezbollah's involvement was centered upon protection of Shia shrines in southern Damascus, but eventually this morphed into Hezbollah being a regional defender of all Shiites in Syria. Hezbollah seeks to keep Assad in power both for its own interests and the interest of Iran. A priority for the group is making sure that Syrian air and land corridors remain open for the delivery of weapons and money from Tehran. Hezbollah's credibility at the same time is being called into question by people throughout the Middle East, including those in Lebanon and beyond Lebanon. Hezbollah insists that it's only fighting to protect Shias in the region and to protect Shia shrines, but it's becoming clearer to both Sunni and Shias that Hezbollah is really not concerned with the welfare of the Lebanese state. So even members of Hezbollah's strongest base, the Shia community, are beginning to question the group's motives after the deaths of so many young Hezbollah soldiers in the conflict. And also, their involvement in the war has really attracted the attention of ISIS and has provoked the group into attacking Lebanon. But it's really unlikely that Hezbollah will cease its involvement in the conflict. Hassan Nasrallah views Syria and Assad as vital to the axis of resistance against Western interests in the region. But as this conflict continues, it's likely that public support of Hezbollah will continue to diminish. So now that we've talked about Hezbollah's background, I'll proceed into the next section of this podcast, which will be dedicated to the crossover between terrorism and criminal activity. So when we think about Hezbollah, typically people think Lebanon, the Middle East, Syria, and I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn the extent of Hezbollah-related activity in the United States, primarily surrounding fundraising. So as I said before, since 2006, nearly 20 Hezbollah-related cases have been prosecuted in 10 states. Many of these cases involved large numbers of defendants, some even over 20 people, who participated in these large revenue-generating conspiracies. The charges in these cases range from providing material support to money laundering, trafficking in counterfeit goods, RICO and racketeering charges, trafficking contraband tobacco, transportation of stolen goods, and bulk cash smuggling. So basically, you name it, Hezbollah has done it here in the United States. And I want to go over a few cases in particular. So the first investigation I want to talk about today was based in North Carolina, and it was called Operation Smokescreen in 2000, and it involved the prosecution of 26 people. So I know what you're thinking. Who cares? This case is dated. It's not anywhere near New Jersey. But this case is important. It's one of the first large Hezbollah conspiracies discovered, and it really set the precedent for how the group would continue to operate in the United States. The investigation began after an off-duty police officer who was moonlighting as a security officer at a tobacco store noticed a large group of men buying huge quantities of cigarettes every day, from 1,000 to 4,500 cartons at a time. Each man would buy just under the legal limit, which was 299 cartons. The officer decided to follow the group and discovered they were trafficking cigarettes across state lines. They were purchasing bulk cigarettes in North Carolina and selling them for a profit in Michigan. So to put this in perspective, at the time, in North Carolina, a carton sold for $14, and in Michigan for $28. So in each carton, they were making over $10 in profit. During the course of the investigation, the drivers would be pulled over in West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee, and be found to be transporting these untaxed cigarettes. The group, trying to avoid law enforcement, started to replace young Middle Eastern drivers with white women. But regardless of these tactics, investigators were able to estimate that the group had purchased $8.5 million in cigarettes and made an estimated $2 million in profit. Evidence in the trial revealed links between ringleader Mohammed Hamoud and Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, including a photo of the two together when Hamoud was a boy. But as they grew up, obviously, the connection continued. Investigators were able to find several receipts totaling thousands of dollars that were sent to Hezbollah charities. But adjusting for the cost of the illegitimate business, there were still hundreds of thousands of dollars that were unaccounted for. Hamoud received a sentence of 30 years in prison, and the Operation Smokescreen case is the first conviction for the federal code of providing material support or resources to a designated foreign terrorist organization. So the next case I want to discuss is more regionally focused and took place in 2009, and involved a number of defendants, all of whom were charged with conspiring to provide material support, while others were charged with actually providing material support. Others were charged with several counts of transportation of stolen goods, trafficking in counterfeit goods, and making false statements to government officials. So a leader in the conspiracy, Musa Ali Hamdan, lived in New Jersey at the time, and the defendants were exporting bulk stolen goods to Lebanon and Venezuela. The contraband included cell phones, laptops, game consoles, and automobiles. So at the same time that they were importing counterfeit goods like pairs of fake Nikes and sports jerseys to sell for a profit here in the United States. So the key to unraveling this case was a well-placed FBI source. And the source eventually grew to be so trusted that he was introduced to a Beirut-based Hezbollah official, Dibhani Harb. Hamdan, who was the New Jersey resident, vouched for the source as someone who could help Hezbollah sell counterfeit currency. From there, the source actually traveled to Lebanon and met with Hezbollah officials. Musa Hamdan eventually moved from New Jersey to New York, and after he was indicted, he fled the country. He was arrested in South America's tri-border area. He was extradited to the U.S. and officially charged in 2011 with providing material support to Hezbollah. So I want to point out that these cases don't always involve millions of dollars flowing into Hezbollah, but this case highlights and underscores the criminal network that's inside of these investigations and which may be even more valuable than money itself. A recent investigation by the DEA underscores the same criminal network that we just talked about. So this complaint highlighted a wide variety of business dealings that a pair of individuals had with associates around the world, including in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. So according to court filings, this investigation determined that between September 2013 and October 2015, the defendants and other Hezbollah-connected associates conspired to conduct monetary transactions to assist individuals who they believed to be drug traffickers in concealing their drug money. In addition to offering to launder narcotics proceeds for a DEA undercover agent who posed as a narcotics trafficker, one of the defendants, Imam Kolbasi, informed him that she had associates in Hezbollah who were seeking to purchase cocaine, weapons, and ammunition. Joseph Asmar, the other defendant, was a high-powered attorney who claimed to have a ton of connections at various banks throughout the Middle East and Europe. He discussed potential narcotics transactions with the undercover officer and suggested that he could use his connections with Hezbollah to provide security to narcotic shipments. Kolbasi and Asmar explained that they could arrange for planes from South America laden with multi-ton shipments of cocaine to land safely in Africa as a transit point where the drugs would be smuggled to the United States or Europe. So during the investigation, undercover agents gave approximately $400,000 in fake drug proceeds to Ms. Kolbasi and Mr. Asmar. They laundered the money back to the United States in exchange for a commission. So in total, the defendants allegedly plotted to launder $8 million in illicit funds on behalf of drug trafficking organizations in Latin America. So although the pair were only charged with conspiracy to launder narcotics proceeds, in this case alone there was discussions of money laundering, narcotics trafficking, weapons and ammunition trafficking, and also using blood diamonds to launder money. I want to talk about a very recent and very large continuing investigation by the DEA. In late January 2016, top members of Hezbollah's External Security Organization's Business Affairs Component, or BAC, in Europe were charged and arrested for drug trafficking and money laundering. So the proceeds were used to purchase weapons and support Hezbollah's involvement in the Syrian civil war. The arrests were a result of a DEA operation called Project Cassandra, which involved law enforcement agencies from 7 countries and targeted Hezbollah's cocaine trafficking into the United States and Europe. So Hezbollah developed business relationships with South American drug cartels that supply cocaine to the U.S. and European drug markets. And according to a DEA spokesperson, Hezbollah was laundering the drug revenue through the shipment of vehicles internationally. In February 2015, European authorities launched an investigation based on DEA leads and discovered a network of money couriers who collect and transport drug proceeds in the form of euros from Europe into the Middle East. The revenue is then transferred to Colombian cartels using the Hawala disbursement system, which is a payment network based on trust and the use of family and regional connections. Officials discovered a large portion of the funds were directed towards Lebanon and to Hezbollah. Again, this case highlights the nexus between terrorism and criminal activity. The DEA was able to prove that the drug money was being used directly to support the group's involvement in the Syrian civil war. Also, this case underscores Hezbollah's unlikely partnerships with Colombian cartels to move narcotics and launder money globally. This is a 2016 case, and it's the last specific case I want to go over. And at the end of this presentation, I just kind of want to review and draw your attention to two reoccurring themes in Hezbollah's criminal activity, which is the group's use of money laundering techniques and the group's use of U.S. maritime ports. So according to federal investigations, Hezbollah has laundered narcotics proceeds through U.S. maritime ports. And this really highlights the group's ability to monopolize on vulnerabilities that exist in the shipment of outbound cargo. So typically, ports throughout the country, the inbound screening process is much more extensive and strict than the outbound screening process. So we're really concerned about what's coming into the country and not so concerned with what's going out. And Hezbollah uses this to their advantage. The 2016 DEA Project Cassandra case I just went over also involved the use of maritime ports. So in this case, individuals were laundering the drug proceeds through the acquisition and sale of high-end vehicles, and they were sometimes concealing money inside the vehicles themselves as they were shipped internationally. In 2011, 3 Lebanese financial organizations and 2 Beirut-based money exchange houses were convicted of wiring at least $329 million in drug proceeds to 30 used car dealerships in the U.S. And one of those car dealerships was located in Bergen County in North Arlington in New Jersey. So the money was sent to these car dealers, and the car dealers would then purchase used vehicles and ship them internationally via U.S. maritime ports. Again, in 2010, the FBI thwarted 2 Hezbollah-linked schemes, one in Virginia in which money was hidden in tires of used vehicles that were shipped internationally, and another in Ohio where a couple was arrested for attempting to conceal $200,000 in a vehicle that they planned to ship to Lebanon. So in sum, Hezbollah time and again launders money through the acquisition of vehicles in the United States and the sale of those vehicles in Africa or the Middle East where they can derive a profit. The group basically takes the drug money, they buy the vehicles, and then they sell the vehicles, making a profit. So they're able to make dirty money, take dirty money, and to make it clean. So the group has capitalized on these maritime vulnerabilities to ship these cars internationally and thus launder their money. Profits from these criminal activities, whether it's narcotics proceeds or counterfeit goods sales, need to be sent back to Hezbollah in Lebanon. And Hezbollah uses multiple forms of money laundering and illicit enterprises, including the informal Hawala money exchange, the Colombian black market peso exchange, or the BMPE, and bulk cash smuggling to sustain their terrorist operations. So Hawala remittance is a system that has been used by a variety of terrorist groups and is really based upon trust. It operates outside most traditional banking and financial channels and employs word-of-mouth referrals and brokers who trust each other. So for example, using the Hawala system, I could send $10,000 to my imaginary friend Bob in Lebanon. So I would give $10,000 to a Hawala dealer here in the U.S. The dealer would then give me a code, and I would give Bob that code. A second Hawala dealer in Lebanon is instructed to pay $10,000 upon receipt of the code. So Bob goes to Hawala dealer number 2, gives the code, and gets the money. So all of this happens without any money actually moving, and it's created no paper trail. The Hawala dealers will be given a commission for their services. Another money laundering technique is the BMPE, or the Black Market Peso Exchange, and this uses international trade to take advantage of trade-based money laundering to disguise proceeds from illegal activity, rendering the entire transaction essentially opaque. So the first step of BMPE is that Hezbollah sells drugs in the United States or Europe. The second step is that using a hawala broker, drug proceeds are relocated to Hezbollah operatives in South America. Step three is that they use pesos from the hawala broker to buy consumer goods such as cars, dishwashers, or, you know, other products, and they're sold legitimately. Step four, the proceeds can be deposited or wired into foreign bank accounts. And the last step is that cash is delivered to Hezbollah-linked accounts ready for use. So this is kind of a general outline of the BMPE, but obviously it can be much more complicated than that in real life. So Hezbollah also practices bulk cash smuggling from the United States, South America, and Europe via couriers and airport insiders. So a 2000 arrest of a ground services coordinator at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport demonstrates Hezbollah's supporters and insiders are willing to bypass airport security to transport packages of cash. And in this case, it was up to $100,000 that was intended to finance Hezbollah operations in Lebanon. So again, Hezbollah uses the hawala disbursement system, the BMP, and bulk cash smuggling to move their money. Finally, I want to wrap up this podcast with a few key takeaways. The first is that the threat of Hezbollah attacking the United States is low. And although the group has targeted Israelis internationally, we haven't seen that activity of plotting or conducting your surveillance surface here in the United States. Secondly, we've talked a lot today about criminal activity the group is involved with. So not only what types, which included narcotics and cigarette trafficking, but also who they partner with, like Colombian cartels, and how they move their money. So through hawala, the BMPE, and bulk cash smuggling. Lastly, federal cases indicate that revenue generated from this criminal activity is directly used to support their operations in the Middle East. And I would argue that no other group exemplifies the nexus between criminal activity and terrorism in the United States more than Hezbollah. So this concludes my podcast. Please feel free to reach out to me or the Analysis Bureau at OHSP for more information or if you have any comments or questions related to this podcast.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.